It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
And that's why putting money down for a timeshare at Thundering Shores Phase 4 is not only a great vacation option, but a sound investment.
Well, I mean, can I talk to my wife about it first, or? What does that mean?
I mean, you're whipped. That's what you're. Oh. That's the sound you're supposed to make when a guy wants to talk to his wife about a major decision.
Is that supposed?
And you don't want him to do it.
Is that supposed to intimidate?
Yes, it is supposed to be a threat to your masculinity.
Oh.
Which can only be responded to by just rashly purchasing whatever I have suggested. I don't know if it works. I've only actually seen it done in TV shows.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know if it would... I know it would not work on you or I.
Yeah.
I would be inclined to respond to that by saying, you ain't kidding. In fact, Trish and I constantly use that technique. If we don't want to make a decision, we're like, we have to talk to that. And according to me talking to people, my wife is the most penny-pinching monster ever.
Really?
Yeah. Because sometimes I'm like, I gotta check with my wife. Often I'm like, I would love to, but there's no way my wife's gonna go for it. She hates this kind of stuff.
Well, I think of consulting with your spouse as a kind of a, not a saying that you don't have the authority to make this decision, but you asserting that neither my wife nor I have the authority to make this kind of decision by ourselves because we are committed
yes.
to making the decisions.
That together. Is the normal, rational thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I use it a lot for door-to-door things and stuff like that. Mm. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast in the world that uses every part of the buffalo. If I used that one before, if I haven't, I can't believe it's taken me this long. That's a good one. That's a solid one. For many years, my podcast uses every part of the buffalo. Nothing goes to waste.
It's actually pretty gross. But
then the white man came. I'm not saying we're not white. I'm saying another guy who happened to be white showed up. I call him the white man. I don't know what his name was. I'm Tony.
And I'm William. And this is episode 290.
And we only have to record one this time. Next week we're going to have to record two. Because I will be unavailable the week after that.
Yeah.
But tonight, just one, so we can get him the heck out of here. Hi, Twiglet. Twiglet's on my lap, wanting a lot of snuggles. For those of you just joining us, here's how this show works. We have a hat. It's magic in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. People like yourselves write into that email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with little notes, little comments, questions, topics, things like that. The hat, all on its own, magically transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written on them that manifests physically within the hat itself. We, its epidemiological servants, draw those note cards out of the hat at random, read them on the air, talk about them till we're bored, do that for about an hour. That's the whole show. And tonight it's probably going to be accompanied by the sound of a lawnmower, because I just told the kids they could mow the lawn, and they went to go get the mower, because I was not thinking. So that's on me, but yeah, he's seen you. He's done. Now, Addy's doing a lot better. At this point, it's mostly just that he's awake more, and he has way more energy. Like, nobody hates him now. were just all like, God, he's so busy all the time. And he came close. In fact, the other night we're sleeping, and Twiglet and Ezzy were snuggled up between Trish and I on the bed, and Addy came to try and snuggle, and Ezzy gave him kind of a half-assed hiss, so he ended up snuggling down like 8 inches away from them, and she was fine with that. So, and the two of them have been playing a lot in like not a mean way. They've been wrestling a lot and stuff, so that's pretty cool. So, how's your week been?
2 weeks.
2 weeks? 2 weeks. Oh, yeah. Because you had to be gone for whatever it was.
Equinox.
That thing.
That was fun. And my sister's birthday was Monday. And my wife actually took the day off so we could go over there for that. And that was cool. Nice.
Get on your mic. I feel like you're not on your mic.
Oh, it's right here. I can't get
it's
any closer.
Too low, though. I think you should tilt it up.
Tilt it up. A lot of shows have come back. We watched Pitch.
Oh, how was Pitch?
A little underwhelming, but it wasn't bad. I mean, you know, we'll keep watching it, see if it gets better.
Mm-hmm.
We watched The Exorcist.
We watched the pilot of The Exorcist.
Yeah, that's all there's been.
Yeah. But I specify it that way because we are not going to watch anymore.
Oh, didn't like it?
It was okay. I decided if Trish wanted to, I would keep going with her for the time being. But Trish was like, I can take it or leave it. So I was like, let's skip it. I feel like I know how it's going to go. I feel like there's going to be a lot of Christian philosophy. And I feel like it's mostly going to be people saying dramatic things and other people not believing them. And I'm going to get tired of that. I was also very surprised. You can speak to this because you see her more often. I guess I had not seen Gina Davis in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
She either has been having some plastic surgery done, or because it's Gina Davis, I suspect the real answer is she just has aged. But she looked very different to me in this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, her face could look very different to me.
No, she looked, I mean, she looked older, sure, but, I mean, she looked the same to me, but like
she was close enough that for a second I was like, is that Gina Davis? And Trish said, of course it is. And I was like, okay.
But as you say, I mean, you know, I've seen her in things lots since.
Yeah.
Forever, so it's...
I haven't seen her in something for a while, so...
But we'll probably... I kind of feel the same way about it, but we'll probably keep watching it just to see how it goes. We watched Blacklist.
Mm-hmm.
Not, you know, just... It was fine. Let's see what else. We started watching... there have been 2 episodes of Van Helsing.
Oh, yeah.
It was better than I thought, but still not, like... blow you away great or whatever.
Dead and Lisa are watching it. We kind of decided we'll just wait till Wynonna Earp comes back. Because it seems like the same show.
Kind of. So we'll probably keep watching that. Just and unless it doesn't go anywhere, then we'll quit. Let's see, what else? Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. came back. This next week, you know, all the CW shows, DC shows are going to be coming back, so we'll be watching those. There are several other new shows that I can't remember that are going to be on the horizon here. So
Timeless is coming out. I think we'll check that out.
Yeah, we'll probably watch
HBO
that
has Frequency something. I will not watch Frequency.
Westworld is on HBO.
That's what it is. Starting Sunday, it's Westworld. I knew there was something. I definitely want to check
that
out.
We'll try that out. But yeah, we'll watch Timeless and Frequency just to see how they go.
Frequency didn't appeal to me. As a premise for a movie, it really doesn't appeal to me as a premise for a TV show. So
I thought the film was all right. I mean,
I didn't see it, full disclosure, but I mean, it just wasn't interesting.
I don't remember a lot about it, but I remember liking it. So mm-hmm.
We'll
give it a chance for that reason. My wife's really into time travel, and as the Doctor Who fans say, timey-wimey type of...
Wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey.
Yeah, narrative, so... I, as we've often discussed, I'm not so much into that, but she is, and I enjoy them when she enjoys them. So we'll watch them and see how they are.
Are there any shows that one of you watches that the other doesn't?
No.
We have very few. It's very hard. I mean, Trish has a few, but I have very little. I recently started watching BoJack Horseman. Did I talk about that before?
Because
it was a little while ago.
Yeah, sounds familiar.
Okay. I'm about 4 episodes in. I'm still enjoying it.
My wife will watch things while I'm gone, but they're usually bad movies. Like, she knows they're bad, and she doesn't want to watch them with me either.
Yeah.
She's mostly going to be entertained if she's watching them by herself.
Oh, I got tons of those. And Trish will rewatch other shows that she used to watch. And I mean, there are some things, like she watched HBO's The Night Of, because she knew that was not at all a thing I was interested in. I'm not very big on true crime, and in general, I'm not big on realistic portrayals of people being horrible.
Yeah. I imagine that she'd probably, I mean, we don't have some rule or something about whether or not either one of us can watch anything that the other person doesn't like.
Yeah.
So I imagine that she would watch TV shows if she thought I wouldn't like it, but for the most part, the only thing she likes that I don't generally like, I think last time we were, when we recorded, because when we record one episode, I'm gone for 2 hours.
We've gone because of driving. Yeah.
And when we record two, I'm gone for three. So I think she watched a movie called Big Ass Spider or something last
time. Oh yeah, I know Big Ass. I haven't seen it, but I'm aware.
She liked it. Thought it was funny, but I mean, you know. She can enjoy a bad movie in probably in a lot of ways that you can't, but that I can't. So.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Sometimes we'll watch a movie she wants to watch that's bad, and she'll still enjoy it, but she enjoys it more when I'm not there because she hates that I hate it.
And it does feel awkward.
And I feel bad, but I can't pretend
and
I like it.
There is the sort of guilty pleasure factor.
Yeah.
So there are things that I'm not even sure necessarily Trish wouldn't like, but I'm like, I feel weird with someone else. There, you know, sometimes.
There's kind of a... there's
that made it sound way more porny than I meant, but you get the idea.
There, in the Venn diagram, that where one circle shows the kind of stuff she's interested in, the other shows the kind of stuff I'm interested in, where it intersects is, when she was growing up, she was a fan of heavy metal music and horror movies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not a fan of either of those things. And today, you know, we're not the same as we were when we were younger, but some of our tastes are sort of similar. But where they intersect is in thrillers.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe supernatural thrillers. I'm not a big fan of those, but sometimes a supernatural thriller can be made and it's kind of good. Like, I liked Skeleton Key, for example. I thought that was pretty good. And things like that. But you know, she's... So as I've gotten older, I've appreciated, it used to, you know, as people know, I'm not really a fiction guy. So fantasy and horror and that genre, I have no real deep appreciation for that. But as I've gotten older, I've found an appreciation for those things in other ways. And as she's gotten older, she's gotten less interested and amused by slasher movies or like Halloween or stuff like that. So we both have kind of moved more toward that middle ground of appreciating thrillers of various kinds. So that's kind of a place we go to a lot when we are sitting down to look at Netflix streaming, for example, to find movies we want to watch. And especially as Halloween gets closer, we fill our queue with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
We've got American Horror Story Hotel that season. That's the last season.
Previous year.
We've got it coming on Netflix discs. So we can watch it throughout October. And so we've been watching a few things horror and thriller oriented already, and it's been kind of fun. We're also still watching The Good Wife, which I think has gotten a little better as the seasons have progressed. And I mean, it's done.
Yeah.
So we'll be, we're probably going to take a break through October because, as I said, we're going to watch American Horror Story and a few other types of horror movies for October. And, also, I'm finding that my wife is becoming a huge fan of Gal Gadot. She's just a fan of hers now. Like, it won't even matter if the Wonder Woman movie is terrible. She's not going to blame it on Gal Gadot. She's going to think...
Lisa's like that.
She's going to think that, you know what, this person was a very well cast as this character, and she came and she did the work, and if the film is terrible, she's not going to blame her at all.
I give Lisa a lot of crap because she has a tendency to... At least I claim, there will be a movie that is terrible, but because it has an actress, always an actress, never a male, in it that she likes, even if they didn't do a particularly good job in that movie, she will like the movie.
Well, I think my wife will be critical if she doesn't perform well, but I don't think she anticipates that's going to happen, and frankly, I don't either.
No, it looks like it's going to be good.
And also, because she's watched a lot of interviews with Gal Gadot, and
yeah.
And she's... She likes her take on Wonder Woman. She likes her take on life. She likes her general positive attitude. And she just likes, you know, she's just grown to like this actor as a person and really appreciates that a person that has this kind of outlook on life and this personality is playing this character that she likes so much and respects so much. It's very much how she loved Linda Carter's Wonder Woman, and she came to love Linda Carter also, yeah, just as an actor in her own right.
And that's how I'm starting to be about Margot Robbie. Although, the thing is, when I hear Margot Robbie talk about things, she's awesome. Her body of work so far is incredibly exploitative, in my opinion. So I find it very sort of confusing. But she's got her own production company, and she's starting to make her own stuff, and I'm kind of excited about that.
You know, that's interesting you should mention that, because my perception has been the same as yours, what you just stated. But I also heard that there's going to be a Harley Quinn standalone movie.
Yes.
That she's going to try to have a little
bit.
She's
in, and she's producing.
Right. And I'm excited to see that, because as you say, it's kind of confusing how the way she, comparing how she what she says in interviews to the roles that she picks.
Well, which honestly, it may have been she had to get her foot in the door.
Well, no, and it's really not fair to judge based on those things. It's like you said, it's confusing. It's you don't quite know how to take.
Well, and I had never really heard of her before Suicide Squad, and then I go back and looking, and basically her breakout role was being naked a whole lot and having sex with Leo DiCaprio in Wolf of Wall Street. That was the thing that put her on the map, and I'm like, oh, that's too bad.
Well, but I mean, it's kind of difficult to tell what all of that means.
Yeah.
It doesn't really tell you
well,
anything.
She spoke out specifically about some of the stuff she had to do as Harley Quinn that she did not like.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, well, this can be interesting, because here's the thing about that character in the animated series. And I heard Paul Dini talking to Kevin Smith about this in an interview. I really got the sense that Paul Dini kind of regretted this character. Like,
yeah.
Like he felt like...
I believe we have discussed this like 12 times on the podcast.
And you could tell that he tried to do something about that in the animated series itself. Like, you know, where she kind of...
Here's a lawn mowing. I apologize, but I'm not doing anything about it.
She kind of came to her senses and got away from the Joker and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it would actually be perfectly in keeping with how the character has been portrayed in other media.
And it would be awesome to not have Jared Leto involved.
For the character to evolve past that kind of thing. And if the actor who portrays Harley is the one that's involved in the production of that and sort of makes that happen, that'll actually be very cool. So we'll see. I'm really interested to see what she does with it. Because it does sound like she's a very thoughtful person when it comes to these things.
Yeah. I'm excited. She's hosting Saturday Night Live for the season premiere this coming Saturday, so I'm going to check that out.
Well, and there's no question how talented she is. I mean,
oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Clearly talented. What about your 2 weeks?
I forgot it was two, so I'm not sure what else happened. I gamed once. I missed one of them. I think I was sick again. I'm sick so much these days. And that's going fine. It's still being kind of silly, but fun silly. I believe we closed the last one with the guy we had just rescued saying, now come with me to go find my brothers. And I'm like, how long ago was this? And he's like, it was a really long time. And I'm like, and the bad guys are there? He said, yeah. I said, so your brothers are probably dead. And he's like, well, I hope not. I said, no, we hope not, but they're probably dead. And he's like, I suppose. I'm like, okay, just want you to be prepared. We're going to go. If we can save them, great, but almost certainly already killed. And he's like, and he was like, what kind of cleric is this? And somebody's like, he's a paladin. He goes, oh, okay, that makes sense. I'm still writing. It sucks. Oh my god, does it suck.
Why's that?
The rewrite is just awful. It's so slow and so difficult.
Yeah, it is. I mean, my experience...
And especially, like, in comparison with the first draft, which, by comparison, was super easy, which I think... My strength is randomly pulling... My strength is improvising a story. The hard part now is going back and tweaking it and making it work. And I mean, and I'm not even to the parts that I know are going to be majorly overhauled, but I've already had to do some changing of stuff. And so, like, I had to just stop completely for a couple days because I'm like, I know this scene doesn't work. I don't know how to fix it. And then I finally got the idea. And so then I wrote it, and I'm about halfway through that chapter, and I'm like, okay, this is going nowhere. We've sort of settled into this really kind of boring conversation. I'm like, crap. So then I'm stuck again, and then I was like, okay, we'll change up the character and do this. And so then I was writing that, and I'm still, and for some reason now, like I told you, I read it, and I was surprised at how good it was. Like, when I get down to the nitty-gritty, now I think it sucks. Both before and after I revise it. It's terrible. But it's progressing. And I'm really at the point I need to plow through this, because at this point, basically, it needs to be out of my head. I need other people to look at it and comment on it. It needs to stop being in my brain, because at this point, I'm just second-guessing myself so hard. The only other thing of real consequence, we saw The Magnificent Seven last night.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. Tell me about it.
You gotta ask. How was that? That's what you're supposed to do.
You often just talk.
It's etiquette. It's just rude. I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Really?
I do not believe Trish liked it as much as me, based on what she said. But I've been wrong before, so we're leaving Trish out of it. I liked it quite a bit. Little disclaimer up front: I have seen neither the original Magnificent Seven nor the Seven Samurai. So I don't have that comparison. Also, it should be said, this movie's not spectacular. This movie isn't original. I mean, obviously it's a remake, but also it doesn't really do anything original. Every aspect of the film, you could probably find a film that did it better. But it's really good and has all really good things put together in one place. It is a Western. It is an action film. If you like those things, we don't get them very often, and this one's good. It's 2 hours and 14 minutes. At no point did I feel like that was too long or, like, wonder when it was over. It has some great performances. It may be my favorite ever performance of both Denzel Washington and Vincent D'Onofrio. It is, without question, the best thing I've ever seen Ethan Hawke do, including Gattaca. It is in my opinion, a vast departure from the kind of roles Ethan Hawke plays, and he does a brilliant job. And Vincent D'Onofrio is a very weird character, and it's pretty awesome. It's probably a waste of Peter Sarsgaard. He's the villain, and he does a wonderful job, but it's one of those that I'm like, I feel like Eric Roberts could have done this and it would have had the same impact, which means you are not using your Peter Sarsgaard to its fullest extent.
I love how you talk about actors like chess pieces.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, because for years I've been in the... My dream was to develop actually a website that you'd look up an actor and you'd find out who their, like, more expensive version was and their cheaper version. I've talked about before.
Yeah,
you can't get this person, you get that person. Yeah. Well, and also just recently I've seen Eric Roberts in some stuff, so I'm like, and he plays villains all the time. It's mostly his shtick. And I'm like, he could have done a perfectly adequate job here. It's not a big part, and it's also a really broadly written villain. It's almost a cartoonish evil in a way. They got the rights to the theme, so the theme to Magnificent Seven is in the movie, which is fun. Chris Pratt does a great job. I mean, it's not at all life-changing, but it was just it was a good, fun movie. It's very violent, obviously. Not especially, like, bloody, but just, like, approximately 15,000 people get shot and killed in the movie. Surprisingly, the sexism and racism is relatively minor. Now, to be fair, it's almost entirely white guys everywhere in the movie. So, like, it's hard to be super racist or sexist when you have no people of color or women in your movie. But there are some, and it's not done too bad. Honestly, the biggest sexism thing is the only real female of significance in the whole movie, who's in it quite a bit, is just showing ridiculous cleavage, just anachronistic, like, just constantly her boobs are just out there, and I'm like, really? This, not only is it not needed here, it seems really out of place in this little tiny western town. Everyone else is wearing a bonnet, and her hair's down, and her boobs are just out there. I'm like, come on.
And it doesn't pass the Bechdel test, I imagine.
Oh, no. Well, we don't have a second woman, so no. I'm trying to think if any other women had lines. It definitely does not pass the Bechdel test. It might pass the sexy lamp test. I believe she was of more significance to the plot than just being an attractive prop.
Sexy lamp.
Yeah, somebody else gave it. It's named after the thing from Christmas Story. Remember when Dad wins the lamp that's just a leg?
Yep.
Not that Christmas Story had anything in that, but they just liked that image. And so they say, could the female lead in the movie be replaced by a sexy lamp? Or more arguably just an attractive prop? Because there are frequently times where she's the MacGuffin, basically. This was not one of those times, I do not believe. So I would recommend it. I mean, if you think that's your kind of thing, I know your wife is big into westerns.
Yeah, I'd say I am too.
There's nothing that particularly is bad. Trish said she feels it's less a western and more an action movie, which I'm like, I feel like most westerns are kind of action movies. This one definitely has a lot of action in it, but I feel like it has quite a bit of character stuff in it, because I really enjoyed the characters, so they were at least fleshed out enough for me to... I was getting the closest thing I could compare it to, and I think it comes up wanting, but it made me feel like Tombstone. I feel like they were trying to do the same thing Tombstone did. And that hasn't happened in a while in a western.
I think the western genre is really kind of hard to pin down.
It is. I mean, especially because it seems like it has morphed more than most over the decades.
Right, because on one hand, it you could just say it's a period piece, you know, set in a particular place and time. And if it's set in that place and time, it's a western. And there's some validity to that, but
yeah. But
there's also other elements. Of course, when westerns originally began, they were fairly. I wouldn't say. I mean,
again,
there was,
sorry about all the
there was
lawn mowing, but I'm not going to do anything.
In
about
conflict,
it.
But it, I wouldn't call the original westerns action movies.
Is there money over by you there? No, over here.
Money? No.
Shoot. Somewhere around here is money that we're going to have to give them when they're finished.
I wouldn't call the original westerns action movies, but the plots weren't exactly complex, you know?
No, not at all, yeah.
Or the character interactions or relationships, you know?
Okay, stand up for a second. Seriously, I had it. Is it under here? They're going to be finished soon, and they're going to be mad if I don't give them money. Kitten, are you hatching it? Okay, new plan. Next to you on the other side on the floor should be my wife's purse. It's a purple thing. That's it, right there. Thank you. Alright, yeah, and I mean, and there's some weird overlap with what you'd call sort of a Civil War drama.
Right, that's something that developed a little bit later in westerns when they kind of just started taking them a little more seriously, like, because westerns are pretty much always set after the Civil War.
Yeah.
Because that's when you have the guns. That's when you have the revolvers and stuff.
And the frontier towns. And
yeah, and so then that becomes a thing, like, well, he's usually a Confederate soldier is looking for work and trying to make amends for some terrible thing that he did, or...
Yep.
You know, and so then...
And there are subplots to that effect in this film.
So a lot of existential themes get introduced, and that starts to become part of the Western genre sort of later.
This movie sort of obliquely dealt a little bit with the concepts of PTSD in that, and
sure,
I was pleased.
Sure.
I feel like a lot of movies don't deal with that in period pieces.
Yeah.
You frequently, if movies are to be believed, PTSD basically got invented in Vietnam.
like it
never happened before then.
Before, yeah.
And I mean, nobody calls it that, obviously, but I'm sorry, guys, but they got to mow the lawn. The grass, it gets tall. People are turning off the podcast right now because it's just too loud. They'll be done soon, and then all will be well. But yeah, I liked it. I've been watching crappy movies. I watched a movie from 1980 called Demonoid that involved a devil's hand. It was like a severed hand that would go around and do bad things. But mostly it would just grab onto people, and then it would possess them, and it would become their hand instead. And then to get rid of it, they would have to cut it off. And for 1980, the effects of the like crawling hand, pretty good.
Yeah.
But what really cracks me up about it is it's a horror movie. It's all about the devil's hand. In the middle, straight up 1970s style car chase scene through the streets of LA, complete with Waka Chicka Waka Chicka music.
Oh man.
It was amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
70s car chases are good.
Right. It just was so out of place here, but it was pretty fun.
It must have been an early 80s film then.
1980.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 1980, yeah. Because you can, I mean, there's a lot of films you can watch that were made in like 82, 83, but it totally looks like 1977. And you just, like, it took a long time for that, actually, that 80s aesthetic to really sink in.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. We all think in terms of the decades. I've been realizing recently, especially watching these like older movies, that you know what? Well, we think of the 70s sort of from like 72 to 84 or so. Yeah. You know, like it's...
That's right.
Well, we think of the 60s. A lot of that was in the 70s.
Yep.
A lot of what we think of as the 50s happened in the 60s.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, but that's pretty much all I got going on, I think. I'm going to go to Icon this year.
Oh, okay.
So here's the thing. This last weekend, Trish was gone, and I was here by myself. And I got a lot done, and that was cool. And that happens sometimes. She travels, and I'm by myself. And it's a cool time. I don't like her being gone too long, but I like being able to have a place to myself for a while, do whatever I want, eat whatever I want, watch whatever I want, you know. And it's not that, like, she stops me, but just the... You don't even have to consider another person, you know?
Yep,
it's kind of fun. It's the benefits of living alone again. But she never gets that, because I don't go anywhere. And I was like, you know what? Maybe I should just start doing that every once in a while. Like, a weekend, and I'll just go to a hotel somewhere and you'll have a place yourself. And then it turned out that Icon, the sci-fi fantasy convention up in Cedar Rapids, is the end of next month.
Yep, as usual.
And I'm like... I don't usually like Icon too much. In general, I'm not good with cons. I think I'm going to have fun, and then I'm just not... It's too involved and too loud and too many people. I don't know, and it's just not that fun. And I was like, well, how about this? Register for the con, get a hotel room, and then go to the con exactly as much as you want and no more. And just hang out. Because I can entertain myself with my computer and Wi-Fi in a hotel room for a weekend. No problem. So that's what I'm going to do. So, I mean, I'll go to Icon some, but I may just hang out in the room. And if I'm having fun, then I won't. You know, we'll see what happens.
That's cool.
Yeah, I'm hoping she'll like that. That's it, though. Let's hat some things. I was hoping, like, I could postpone it long enough for the lawn mowing to stop. But the hat gets mad when you lawn mow over its questions.
Let's see. Anonymous.
Oh, Anonymous. My favorite listener.
Just to hear your reactions, a short story about surprises. Once upon a... Boo! Were you surprised?
I was incredibly surprised.
I wasn't because I'm reading it, so it didn't surprise me.
Alright, well, you want me to read it to you and you can see...
Yeah, go.
Alright. A short story about surprises. Once upon a... Boo!
No, not really.
Alright.
I kind of saw it coming.
I was scared enough that I made no sound. I was incapable of sound for that instance. But William can attest, I did thoroughly urinate myself.
Yep.
And that was out of fear. Sometimes I do it for fun. This was out of fear. So, well done, Anonymous.
I saw it coming.
I can't think why you wouldn't want to attach your name to that.
I saw it coming.
Well, you write screenplays and stuff, so like you can see when people are telegraphing.
Yep, yep.
Twists.
Yeah.
Like that. Very Shyamalanian.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know.
Shyamalanian ding dong. Shyamalanian. I'm gonna stick with that.
Is that the last stop? Do you think?
I have no idea. I don't know how lawns are mowed. That's a knock at the door, so they probably didn't stop just to say we're halfway done. He's like, who the hell is that guy?
He's saying, that dude lost weight.
Got taller.
No.
Wearing a hat.
No, you're taller than me.
Really? How tall are you?
I'm only about, well, with my boots on, probably 6'1 and a half, 6'2 maybe?
I am exactly 6'1 and a half.
Without shoes on?
Yes.
Okay, well, so you're taller than me.
Yeah, but you're wearing shoes, so at the moment, we're the same height. No, realistically, probably just thinks all white guys look alike, so.
Yeah, probably.
I don't blame him. I can't tell us apart sometimes. Which one am I?
You're Tony.
This is interesting. Addie just came down from the kitty condo, went over to where Twiglet was laying on the couch, and just sort of climbed on him, and then started chewing at him until Twiglet finally responded. And now they are wrestling. Sort of. Addie keeps getting distracted. It's kind of like hugging with teeth.
I suppose you should draw something.
I'm way more into this here. Watch the histocuffs.
People have to.
It's good radio.
People are listening.
Listening to a guy watching. We should do color commentary. You know?
I don't know how to do that.
Twiglet's been defending two champions, but I think Addie just wants it more.
But now it's over.
They're done. There was not. I guess Addie's the winner in that he made Twiglet run away. Good job alienating your brother.
But he's not even claiming the spot.
Nope.
Walking away.
Just wanted to fuck with him. Coffee says, describe something that you liked today. Do you think she means we should describe something that we liked and we should describe it today?
I think she means something that happened today that we liked. Or that
All right. I've got a good one.
Go right ahead, be my guest.
Well, thanks in part to Bill Cosby, California just passed a law that removes statutes of limitations on rape cases.
Oh.
Now, it doesn't retroactively change earlier cases, so it will have no impact on him. None of his earlier cases now get reopened. And actually, the current one that he's going to probably go to trial for is in Pennsylvania. But in large part to him, that was what spearheaded this, and so now that's happening.
I didn't know he was being charged with anything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, one of them was from 04, so it's not outside the statute. And so they're going to trial. They've actually set a trial date for June of next year.
Boy. Well, let's see.
So I was pleased about that.
At some point today, I was directed to a YouTube video of some of Paul Lynn's best moments from Hollywood Squares.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
I was just laughing. I just can't. When I remember when I was a kid thinking, how does he do that? They ask him a question, and sometimes immediately, maybe he takes a few seconds, but he always had something just totally hilarious to say.
And you know they had those written down usually.
But they didn't know who was going to...
No, they just had them prepped for all of them.
For every single question that was going to be
asked? Supposedly there was a joke question and there was a serious one, like, written down, yeah.
But it was the players that was saying this, you know, this person. How did they know which question they were going to get?
Well, how many questions do you have in an episode?
Oh, well, I mean, Yeah, you're probably right. Probably just a couple dozen.
Well, and to be fair, I think my primary evidence for this was an episode of The Simpsons, so I might not know what the fuck I'm talking about. But Paul Lynde is hilarious.
I mean, it really seemed like he was shooting from the hip, though. So funny.
And apparently just an unapologetic asshole in real life, of the kind that I like. Like, he was just a jerk and knew he was a jerk, and he was fine with it. And as I believe I've mentioned on here before, the great urban legend of Paul Lynde is that one time he was on a plane with a crying baby, and he was known to have said, "Somebody shut that baby up, or I'm going to fuck it."
What?
That's what he said.
No, he didn't say
Supposedly that is what he said. It does sound like something he would say off camera. And I suppose that's a hell of a threat to get you to shut your baby up. But in a twist, it turned out it was a chicken, and it died, and he was very distraught over it for weeks afterward. Are you not getting this reference? Come on.
Nope.
End of MASH?
Mm-hmm.
Seriously. Okay, people, spoiler for the end of MASH right now. Get ready for that. Did you ever see the end of MASH?
I don't think I did.
End of MASH, one of the plot lines is Hawkeye's in basically an asylum. I mean, he's still in Vietnam, but they've locked him up.
Korea, you mean?
Sorry. He's still in the war that they were pretending to be, not the war that they were commenting on. Sorry. Yes. Korea.
A TV show that lasted far longer than the actual war that they were...
That they were commenting on. because of something that happened, and we don't know what, and we get Sydney, you know, the recurring psychologist who was on the show.
Oh, yeah,
he's there, and he's doing some therapy stuff with Hawkeye. And it comes up that this Hawkeye lost it after there was some instance where he was in a bus with a busload of civilians and, like, North Koreans were coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were trying to hide out, and everybody's trying to be quiet. But this one person had a chicken, and it wouldn't stop making noise. And they were going to get caught. And he's like, "You need to shut that chicken up." He's finally like, "Shut up that chicken now." And so the person who had the chicken tried to cover it so it wouldn't make noise, and ended up smothering it to death. And then we eventually find out he's displaying it wasn't a chicken, it was a baby.
Oh.
And I believe he said that's his thing. He's like, "It wasn't a chicken, it was a baby." And it was such an iconic moment that it frequently gets pulled out as a trope.
I had never heard of that.
Yes, so I was switching it up with, it wasn't, Paul Lynde wasn't talking about a baby, it was actually a chicken that he was threatening to fuck. And then he was terribly distraught about it afterward.
I did not see the end of MASH now that I think about it.
Oh, you should.
I remember when it ended and I didn't see it.
And then they did After MASH, which was just awful. And also kind of a creepy play on words.
Yeah.
Oh, so you liked the video about Paul Lynde.
Yeah,
I liked the losing the Statue of Limitations. Here's the, I don't know if I liked it, but it was interesting. So, you've never watched Portlandia?
I think we watched like one episode or something.
Okay.
Didn't really do anything.
One of the recurring bits on it, or one of the recurring scenarios, I guess, is a feminist bookstore called For Women Only, I believe. And the owners are Carrie Brownstein and Fred Armisen, both playing women.
Mm-hmm.
And it frequently has a lot to do with them working really hard to try and be victimized, with them just ignoring any semblance of a business, and with them being like hyper offended about things, and just sort of like getting confused and reductionist about their feminism in weird ways, and just other stuff, just that they're sort of bad people. It's not a funny bit. I don't like it. But it's, of course, the exterior shots and everything. Well, and actually, the interior, apparently, is an actual bookstore in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, now it's been 6 years, that bookstore has decided they don't want to work with Portlandia anymore, and they have decided so almost violently. They literally have a sign in their door now, like in the window, that says "fuck Portlandia" and accuses Portlandia of transmisogyny and racism and aiding gentrification. Also, and they wrote this almost manifesto of like all the things they hate about it and how bad they've screwed them over and all this. And it's really weird. Like, it's one of those that I'm like, I'm sure you have valid points. You have kind of invalidated them with the way you've done this. And there are several things that are like, well, they have a big thing about, like, in this day and age, everybody's like, ha ha, look, Fred Armisen in a dress, isn't that funny? And we're like, I'm not sure that was the joke of that character. But I mean, and there's stuff that I think is legitimate. And they get mad, to be honest, a lot of people in Portland get mad about Portlandia. Which, to a degree, I get, and to a degree, I think they're missing the point. But, so yeah, they were really mad about that. I don't have a lot going on, so it's the kind of news I keep up with. All right, draw another thing.
Okay. This was one of those days that you were talking about writing and how difficult it is when you're rewriting. I'm working on episode 3 of my bigger project, and you know, it's I've got an outline for the first 13 episodes, and so I just, what I'm doing is I get to the next episode, I plug in the outline, and then I fill it in.
I'm a little bit, I'm doing something like that now. I'm taking the original and I'm, or the first draft, and I'm copying and pasting that chapter and then sort of writing over the top
kind of
it.
The same kind of thing. Yeah. And I'm at a place now where I've got it all formatted like a screenplay, and I've filled in all, you know, it's 60 some pages long, and this particular episode probably has to be longer. It usually translates, you know, I'm writing hour long episodes and it usually translates to a minute a page, but there's quite a bit of description. Yeah. So I probably have to be 65 minutes.
Keep in mind, though, with commercials, you need to drop that down to like 40 minutes.
No, I'm just going to run for an hour.
All right, but your only hope is PBS or the BBC.
But so I'm at this place where, all right, now it's kind of time to sort of refine this and figure this out. Maybe I need to add a scene to give it some length, or delete this scene because it's not working. And sometimes I can spend 8 hours straight just reading it over and over and over again and not having a single idea, and I don't accomplish anything at all.
Okay, that's insane. I would be terrified if I had that for 8 hours. But I now have experienced firsthand the whole, you're just staring at like that one sentence being like, tell me what to write next! Come on!
It's worth it down the road, because every step along the way is putting, somewhere in your unconscious, is putting the pieces together to give you that flash of insight you have, you know, 10 or 12 hours later, and you go, oh, that's what I have to do.
Yeah.
So it's worth it, but you know, we live in a culture that is very judgmental about what is productive time, you know, like, especially writers, they get this, well, how many pages did you do today kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, don't, you can't think about it like that.
No, I keep trying to think about it in terms of, I haven't quit.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, I'll be like, I'll have a day or two where I don't write. But then every once in a while I'll be like, I don't think I've written in like a week. That's not okay. So then I have to get back to it.
Jazz wants to know, how would you compare fiction in any form with nonfiction as a means of influencing society?
All right. Well, according to this, we got about 12 minutes left. So let's take this question, which could legitimately be a semester-long course.
You think?
Absolutely.
I don't know.
Well, first of all, we got to dissect all the different ways in which the two influence the nonfiction alone. Like the level of, like, there's the aspect of certain ways you write nonfiction. It seems very official and news-like, and certain people at least, are likely to accept it as truth because it is presented as nonfiction. Versus fiction, where you can always say, oh, it's a story. But then people say, oh, based on a true story. And then people buy into that. But that frequently is a lie. And then there's nonfiction that is legitimately just sort of factual. But then there's nonfiction that is clearly not factual. And
well, right. I mean, there's a level at which it's all storytelling. I mean,
yeah,
the
absolutely.
Distinction between fiction and nonfiction is sort of
just by the fact that humans are unreliable narrators.
Right,
I mean,
right,
yeah.
Right. But I think that another way to approach this is to me the value in that construction that we have in our culture between fiction and nonfiction, the value there to me is that fiction is okay. We have a culture that really encourages a lot of neurotic kind of things, you know, denial and repression and things like that. And that means that a lot of times nonfiction, if we define it as something that's sort of imparting scientific or factual or, you know, verifiable historical data or whatever, mm-hmm. that there might be resistance to that if it's challenging a person's denial or repression or whatever, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And since probably the stories, and again, it's all story, fiction or nonfiction, it's all storytelling. If when you're talking about stories that benefit society, more often than not in our culture, you're going to be talking about stories that help a person probably deal with that repression and deal with
now,
that
to be fair, she did not say bettering society or helping society. She said influencing society.
Okay, fine.
So we can do some bad shit if we want to.
No, that's true. And actually, what I'm saying does go both ways. I mean, I'm saying improving society, but the very same things that tools you use to improve it also break. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you're the people who are trying to improve society are probably going to want to go after those repressive and those denial aspects to try to turn them around. And of course, the people who want to make society worse or to take advantage of the weaknesses of society are going to reinforce the,
yes, that encourage repression. Yes.
But both sides of that are probably going to use some of the same tools. And it seems to me that in our culture, especially, fiction is especially good for that because...
That stew is a little spicier than usual. Be prepared.
The fiction...
You guys at home get to just try and decide what that random sentence meant.
Fiction can manipulate those things without the person realizing that's what's going on. I mean,
I was thinking in the same way. I was going to say fiction can be more subtly subversive because it's just a story. Just a story. But I'm not sure that's true because for people... the best example I can think of, people who are freaking scared of Harry Potter because it teaches you devil stuff and whatever. Okay. And the truth is, it's just a goddamn story. But those same people, if you wrote a nonfiction piece, even a fairly factual nonfiction piece, on modern neo-paganism that did not buy in with what they think it means, they would just claim that was a lie, it was a fake story, like it wasn't true. So I don't know. Fiction can be more subtle in its influence and its subversion, but I don't know that it's necessarily more effective or more common.
But it's direct. I mean, it's trying to say something very specific, and it's...
Wait, fiction or nonfiction?
I'm sorry, nonfiction.
Yeah.
Sorry, I got confused.
That's true. Nonfiction less often masks its intent.
Exactly. But...
Or at least it would be much more complicated
But fiction can do that.
Fiction usually does.
Yeah, in fact, the best fiction does.
Yeah.
The best fiction is the kind that you walk away from and you realize that somehow, you don't know how or when it happened, but your perspective has changed because of watching this and you don't even know how that happened.
Well, and it could, as with like poetry, it can be different. I remember having seen Civil War, Captain America Civil War, and having discussion with people on whose side, well, and we discussed it here, whose side we thought the movie wanted us to take. And all the opinions were there. The people who said, siding with Captain America, the people who said, siding with Iron Man, people who said, I think you're supposed to think they're both terrible decisions. The people who said, I don't think it had an agenda along those lines. And the fact that all of us saw the same thing and got that out of there happens less with nonfiction. Yeah. It can happen. But more commonly, it's like, well, what did they want us to do? Well, right here, they say do this, so that's they wanted us to do. Unless you're being satire or whatever.
And nonfiction, don't get me wrong, nonfiction can be transformative. all the most transformative stories I've ever heard are nonfiction.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
And it can be dramatic. It can be, you know.
But also, nonfiction often employs fictions of metaphor and parable and things like that to get the point across. I mean, I would say that Carl Sagan's Cosmos was one of the most transformative things I've ever experienced as a kid. And of course, as I often say, nonfiction is all I really cared about when I was young. It's, mm-hmm. it's mostly what I read now still. So nonfiction can be transformative, but you have to be the kind of person who's open to that direct, you know, transformation.
Agree.
And our culture teaches people to be suspicious of things that are trying to be transformative. And a lot of nonfiction, it starts right out. A lot of nonfiction starts with their thesis or their premise or what they think they're going to teach you or explain to you. In other words, they start out saying, this is how what we're about to tell you is going to transform your life. But our culture teaches you, this is why people are suspicious of intellectualism and smart people and whatever in our culture, because, you know, you've got to guard yourself against being influenced by these people that'll change your mind.
Well, and this is, thinking back to, as a kid and a friend who was a Latter-day Saints and really wanted me to read the Book of Mormon. And I was just at the age where my answer was, okay, I'll read that if you read Spiral Dance by Starhawk. Mm. And they would not. Oh. They had no interest in that whatsoever. Meanwhile, this same person reads all sorts of fantasy novels. Loves them. Is a big fan of them.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because they're just stories.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that in our culture, I think one of the reasons why people who want to have influence in our society for good or ill, I think the reason they gravitate to fiction is because they know that people are willing, like you just said, they think it's just a story. They don't think of it as something that's going to attempt to or succeed in transforming them. And I think they might avoid fiction because nonfiction, they think they avoid nonfiction because it starts out saying, you know, telling you what their thesis statement is basically saying. This is how we're going to try to transform you by giving you this information. And a lot of people don't want to have a transformative experience.
I've always figured I don't like nonfiction as well. Just I think it's not as interesting. It's more boring.
That's true for most people.
I definitely prefer to write fiction because I like being able to put on another face. I'm like... I like being able to talk out my ass. But that's the thing. I would not write a nonfiction piece from the perspective of someone who had drastically different views than me on something. Mm. I would not write an essay on the horrors of abortion and how pro-life is the only way to go. I would totally write a story about a rabid pro-lifer.
But I'm just the opposite. I find fiction often to be very boring because I don't know why I should care. Whereas nonfiction, I almost can always see how I have a stake in what's being talked about because it's real. Or you know what I'm saying? It's out in the world. It's something that might impact me directly, or it might impact other people, which I care about people, so it impacts me that way. And that's what interests me. Fiction oftentimes totally bores me because I don't know why I should even care about what's going on in the story.
Yeah, whereas I prefer to be entertained.
But see, I'm being entertained by nonfiction. That's just it. It's not that you're being entertained and I'm not. We just appreciate.
No, but I think if what you're seeking out is how it matters to you, I'm not sure that falls under the rubric of entertainment. It's most entertaining to me when I feel like it impacts my life directly. That sentence sounds weird to me.
You
could say it's most interesting to me,
but
if it impacts my life directly.
If I'm entertained by being interested, I mean, being entertained just...
Well, entertainment is in the eye of the beholder, but to me, I hate to use this because we already use the Venn diagram of interesting and entertaining overlaps, but is not a singular circle. There is stuff that I find interesting that I do not find remotely entertaining. And there's stuff I find entertaining that I don't find that interesting.
I'm not sure I can be entertained by something that I don't think is interesting.
And that's because you don't do enough drugs.
Give me an example of something that entertains, but
that
isn't interesting.
See, I have an easier time in the other direction, but... I think that's wherein I watch old episodes of sitcoms that I saw before and things like that. Mm. There can be sort of entertaining aesthetically. Mm. I will admit, it's not something that comes up real often. Much more common the other way. Like, this is interesting to me, it is not at all entertaining. And that's frequently... I mean, that's why I buy nonfiction books. Because they are interesting to me. Many of them are not entertaining, and that's why I buy them and then I don't read them.
I guess I just really love the experience of being interested in something.
Yeah, see, I'm way more... I mean, I guess it is interesting. I'm... Especially nowadays, I'm into... how do I feel about the narrative? And it has no basis on whether or not it's true or it's relatable to me or anything. Just... How was the narrative?
Yeah, I guess I can. I think about it that way too.
But you are well, and but one could argue if it's an interesting narrative, you know.
Yeah.
I guess we were talking interesting in more of a narrow perspective of how it impacts your life, and that. But yeah.
But
if it's wholly, I mean, frequently, if I decide I don't want to watch a movie or a TV show or something, it's like I'm just not at all interested in that. So
part of the problem here and how we're talking about it is, though, is I take a fairly studious perspective to just about everything.
Yes, you do.
So
it's why I can't stand you.
That's another reason why I don't relate a lot to people who enjoy.
Whereas I tend
fiction.
To take a very drunken hobo stance to most things.
I don't even know what it's like to take a non-studious perspective to something. I mean, I realize that's a thing. I realize I do this and other people don't.
I find that surprising.
But I have a hard time...
Because you've hung out with me a lot. The stuff you see me doing, that's taking a non-studious approach.
Okay. All right.
As someone once said, like 3 minutes ago, I like talking out my ass. We're out of time. We're over time.
Okay.
So, get out of my house. We love you guys. Not enough to schedule lawn mowing around our recording, but enough to apologize for it and then do nothing. Go to the blog, themagicaltalkinghat.com, and tell us whether we're interesting or entertaining or both. Because you're still listening, so... What the hell, man?
We have the weirdest conversations sometimes.
Like us on Facebook, because nobody does that anymore. It makes me sad. Not too sad, because I kind of hate Facebook, but still. Go out and mow your lawn. It's a nice night. Probably needs it. Or pay a kid. That's what I do. I pay a kid for most things. I don't even go to the bathroom anymore. Mm-hmm. I pay a kid to do that. Mm-hmm.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.